So hello and welcome to the Anime Podcast. Hope your week has been filled with many Twitter spats and aggro on melts, dear listeners. Today we're going to be talking about the Paris Commune. And it's just another two-hander with me and Alex. So today, Alex is going by the Jitsi handle of Androna Blanca. How are you getting on, Alex?
I'm all right. It's minus seven here, dear listeners. And I live in a boat, which was a big topic in the first season that's completely been dropped off, as often happens with shishy TV shows. The main arc of the original season has ceased to be a main topic. But yeah, I live in a boat, and I am basically frozen solid in a canal somewhere in the Midlands of Ireland. So I'm doing as best as I could be in those circumstances, James.
And I'm going by the Jitsi handle of Montfatre. So I haven't really got much to report, just been working all week. Talking about cum pancakes on Twitter, mostly. So
like a rube.
Like a rube. So yeah, we might as well just get straight into it. So usually when we do an episode, Alex is the one that knows the most, and since he's the historian and has the time at the moment to do as much research as he can do in a week. And the rest of us are usually got some points that we're going to pick up on or some theories that we'll bang out and sort of do it. But this week, despite the fact that I spent a good chunk of the week only dedicated to reading about the Paris Commune, it's such a dense and complicated topic that even the 9-12 hours I put into it, I basically know next to nothing. So it's going to be a very one-sided conversation. But we'll start.
It's a normal episode of the podcast, then.
Well, one day we'll do an episode about having sex with women, Alex, and then you'll be way out of your depth.
Pulling my collar, boy.
So we're going to... What I'll do is just do a very, very brief introduction. A lot of people start way, way back at the French Revolution and try and work their way forward, but we do not have time for that. So all you have to know is that France... as the Second Empire was at war with Prussia. What is Prussia? It doesn't matter. It's too complicated. Anyway, Paris is surrounded by the Prussians, and Paris at this time is at odds with the rest of France. The rest of France is mostly agricultural farming land with very Catholic and conservative citizens, where Paris itself is a hotbed for dissidents and revolutionaries. France loses the war with Prussia, and that topples that regime, so there is an interim government. That's how you get the Third Republic of the French. Now, within Paris, there's a group called National Guard, who have their roots in the Revolutionary Army of Napoleon at the start. They are not professional soldiers. They are citizens that, for various reasons, have joined this guard. So when there's a truce with the Prussians and they have to give up the arms, the National Guard actually keep theirs because it is for looking after citizens rather than being for army reasons for fighting the Prussians. So they're allowed to keep their arms, which means when the provisional government go into Paris and go to the Mont section to take some cannons away, these cannons are seen as very important to the citizens of Paris. They're basically symbols of their freedom and their ability to defend themselves. And as the interim government tries to take them away, they end up in a skirmish with the National Guard. And then this kicks off effectively a taking over of the city by the National Guard, and the takeover for 62 days. And this is what is called the Paris Commune. So that is about as brief as I could get it into. Alex, have you got any points that I missed or any important information that's going to be essential for what you're going to be talking about in the podcast?
Just a couple of things. You don't need to go back to the French Revolution, but in a form of a sentence, really, which is that there had been a kind of class struggle in France going on for over 100 years. The various revolutions, whether it be 1789 through 1793, 1794, before the reaction took over, whether it be the July 1830, whether it be the 1848 revolutions across Europe, they're all part of kind of broader the kind of class struggle that's emerging in France, and in particular, it was the most populous and at one point the most powerful state in Europe. It is also a very odd state. It industrializes very late. In many ways, the coming to power of the Napoleons actually kind of push the state in a rather haphazard way forward. And so basically in the 20 years before the commune, you're having a lot of things are going on. There had been a coup written about famously by Karl Marx and the 18th premier of Louis Napoleon, a very famous quote about history repeats itself first as tragedy in regards to Napoleon Bonaparte, and second as farce after his nephew took over. And he does change things. He invests hugely in infrastructure, invests in basically trying to build the economy up. And even towards the end, he was allowing strikes, he was letting unions, he was letting universal suffrage, and things were beginning to change. And really, there was three big blocks. This is the last thing I'll say. Three big kind of blocks on the left that were waiting for something to happen to take advantage of what was happening in France and Europe. One was the Blanquists, who were the followers of Louis Blanqui. I'm not going to pronounce any of the French names correctly. That's just the way I am. And he was kind of a proto-Leninist, actually. Believed in the revolutionary vanguard and kind of a dictatorship of the proletariat. Had been around forever. There was the Proudhonists, who were basically our ancestors, the original anarchists of the time, who followed Joseph Marie Proudhon. Again, I'm not going to pronounce any of the names correctly. And again, anarchist self-explanatory. If you listened to this podcast before, go back to the episode about what is anarchism. That's who they were. And you had the last group, which was basically the neo-Jacobins, who were the followers of kind of the revolutionary kind of government of like 1789 through to around 1793, 94, kind of Robespierre. They believed fully in the idea of kind of Paris being the cockpit of France, and basically the rest of France should do what Paris wants to do. And so these guys are all waiting in the wings when the war with Prussia happens and what we're going to talk about happens.
Yeah, France in the 1800s is really dense and complicated. And if you were, say, like, you know, someone like Victor Hugo, who I think was born in, like, bang on 1800s, and he lived until 871, something like that. The amount of history that he lived through is gobsmacking. So, you know, he was there for the revolution in the 30s, which is what Les Mis is about, and then he wrote poems about the commune and things like that. So and he also had to obviously leave France for a time because of, you know, how tense political situations were. And I think I'm sure the French know loads about it and get taught it in school, but it is something that is not really discussed in history. Even the commune, actually, I think is very rarely touched upon. And I think it is really important because it basically sets the rhythm and the tone for basically every leftist struggle since. I think, you know, there's that idea that Alan Moore says about Jack the Ripper basically birthed the 21st century, or the 20th century, by his actions. And I think that I understand what he means by that, because it's like, you know, the way that the media worked themselves up into a frenzy about Jack the Ripper, and the, you know, the way that it is to do with, you know, killing to be famous, et cetera, et cetera. I think in the same way, you know, you could say the same about the commune, where it is very much like, once you actually go back and look into it and see, you know, the power struggles within the commune, but also more importantly, what happens with the interim government and their reactions to it. And, you know, as we get to the bloody week, it suddenly slots in quite a lot of, you know, what's happened in the 20th century. So I would say that's why the commune is important now for us to be discussing. It's not just some far back historical, you know, piece of information that we're interested in. You know, we're always trying to link these things into the here and now. So why would you say that it's an important for us to discuss now?
I think it's important to discuss for a couple of different reasons. It can give you a blueprint for how revolutionary events become possible, which is very important. The kind of collapse of quote-unquote legitimate government in the face of wars or natural disasters or whatever, gives you a kind of blueprint for how you build an organization. So you need to have some type of support from an armed wing, whether it be the National Guard in France, whether it be the Russian army, whether it be, you know, Spain was different. Obviously, they had to create their own militias there, but there's always an element of that there. You're going to need people who've been thinking and proselytizing these ideas for decades, which is what happened, what was happening in Paris in particular for 100 years. And finally, you're going to need an event, the kind of this kind of X factor, which comes into it, which in the case of the commune was somewhat the defeat by Prussia, was somewhat the siege, which went on for 5 months and locked them out from the rest of the world. And some of it was just a random event. These the kind of bourgeois government of really monarchists sneaking in the election in February and then trying to stamp out what they saw as the much greater danger, much more dangerous than the Germans invading and defeating them. No, that was, you know, whatever. But you need to stamp out these working class sans-culottes and make sure that they never reappear again. So, I mean, those series of events are not going to be repeated exactly, but there's a lot of the same things we've seen when it comes to Spain. We'll eventually talk about Russia. And I'm, from what I remember, a lot of those same events happened there. So it is kind of a blueprint for how you, if you want to achieve these things, if you want to try and change society, or, you know, these type of events occur, and it'd be best to be a Blanque or one of the, or a Proudhonist who had learned his history, let's just say, and is able to kind of use that in the present. So yeah, that's why I think it's important. It's like the perfect blueprint for revolution, if you want to achieve that.
So before we go on to actually how, you know, where the successes were by the commune, just take us through the, so there's basically the standoff in Montmartre with, you know, the interim government about the cannons. So tell us how they basically were able to take over the city.
Well, you'd had the siege, which went on for 5 months, and there was about 400,000 regular troops and about 400,000 regular troops, pardon me, and the National Guard. The National Guard had been, at least originally, heavily kind of middle class, but with the need to defend Paris, they let in a huge amount of working class people, and the working class were there, so therefore the Blanquists and the Proudhonists kind of came into the National Guard as well and began agitating within the defense forces. And so by the end, they were really kind of dedicated to resisting what they saw was militaristic, authoritarian Prussia, and what was beyond that, which was militaristic, authoritarian France. They even play a role somewhat in the kind of downfall of the empire in I think it was October or September of 1870. So there's a lot going on there. And anyway, they're very surprised when the government that's formed in, I think in Tours, but it's in the south of France, decides to, for an armistice that would have been, I think, 5 billion francs to be paid, which was the equivalent of about 4 trillion for America if they lost the war with Germany in the here and now. As well as, of course, famously Alsace and Lorraine being taken, and a victory parade through Paris, which in particular was salt in the wound. And they refuse to kind of demilitarize at all. And so there's the mayor of Paris communicates, I think maybe directly with Otto von Bismarck, but it might have been with the provisional government, and says, no, we need to keep our weapons here because of the circumstances in Paris. And he goes, all right, fair enough. You know, lots of working class people there. That makes sense. And so the cannons, I think 400 cannon and all their rifles are kept in their hands. And so Paris remains a viable kind of military element, something which could not be stood, whatever, by the end of March or middle of March, anyway, when the government sets up shop in Versailles and very much looks like it's going to try and reestablish the Bourbons or the House of Orléans, and they send in the army to try and take the guns away from them about 3 a.m. And it would have worked, but for the fact they didn't bother to bring any horses to carry the guns away. And so they have to wait around. And when they do wait around long enough, the Parisians wake up and go, wait a second, where's my coffee? No, wait, I've had my coffee. Wait a second, there's some army people here. And it all kicks off from there, really. They had no time whatsoever for, as you said earlier, they saw that privilege of having their own weapons, their own National Guard, and the freedom that came with choosing their own officers. It was a very democratic structure at that point. They saw this as a direct attack, and they weren't illiterate in their own history. They knew very, very well what had happened in 1848, what had happened in 1830, what had happened in the 1790s, and they were not going to let it happen again. So really, that kind of is why, in particular, it kicked off at that exact moment.
And just from a tactical standpoint, now this is something that I've always kind of known, but I always find it difficult to remember exactly when it happened. But I mean, if you know Paris, you've been to Paris, you know how big and wide the streets are. And that was done on purpose to make it harder to build barricades. And it also means that you can use artillery in the middle of the city, which obviously would have been important in the 1800s. So Paris is kind of now designed specifically to stop this sort of thing happening again. Now, the way those streets existed, was that before the Commune, or were they built after the Commune when parts of the city had been shelled and destroyed?
Louis Napoleon had them designed by his chief architect in the 1850s and 1860s so that there would not be a repeat of the June insurrection in 1848, when the working class districts rose up against what was becoming the Second Republic, which was a very conservative bourgeois republic in the end, before it was toppled, of course, by Louis Napoleon. So yeah, it was there beforehand, and it would be used with great effect by the French army to murder enormous amounts of people, because it's sad, but I don't think any of them really realized why the boulevards had been widened in the way they were. But it was, as you said, it was deliberately because of the threat of barricades and the threat of the working class kind of holding these areas, and the army being unable to flank them or being able to deal with the kind of defenses, you know?
But yeah, it definitely seems like, you know, the mistake that the left have made in certain aspects in the 21st century is not picking the correct ground to have standoffs on. Because, you know, once you get a barricade up, you can't get kettled. So it's much, you know, in some places it's very difficult, depending on where they're built. But, you know, say like Dublin, for instance, there's plenty of places where there's very narrow streets, and it's a lot easier to, you know, to make a wedge point rather than just have it straight on the canal, which has got this huge, wide open space where you can effectively, you know, let the Garda have their one line backed up with police cars, you know, and horses. And you know, you see that happening in London all the time. You know, Edinburgh was a very different situation, even though we never really had anything that got that interesting in our time in Edinburgh. But these are the sort of things that you should be looking at if, you know, things are going to be getting a lot more interesting. So tell us where the Commune succeeded and why we should be sort of in awe of some of their successes.
Well, I mean, I think to hold a city like Paris for even 62 days, given the circumstances, is astounding. To be able to resist, I think they sent in 15,000 troops. To be able to resist that, to push them out of the city, to have a period of time when, if they'd acted appropriately, they could have marched on Versailles and decapitated the government. Yeah, but the kind of the head of the new government in Versailles had only maybe 20,000 not particularly well-armed or loyal troops in Versailles. And if they had taken advantage of this opportunity, you could have had a major countrywide event. That wasn't something necessarily they succeeded at, because they didn't do it. But it does suggest there was a window there. Other than that, what they did was they made a kind of, they had an election. They didn't do what the Blanquists wanted them to do, which was have a kind of military dictatorship, or not, well, a revolutionary dictatorship. Anyway. They had elections quite soon afterwards, universal manhood suffrage. They weren't yet into women having the vote. And French people, oddly, were taking quite a long time to get to have that happen. But what do they do when they had power, or when things are completely under control? It's a couple of things they do. They bring in, there's no night work allowed anymore. There was a lot of people working in bakeries, and kind of their health was suffering. So there's no more kind of work late at night. They brought in nurseries, kind of childcare. They brought in basically a type of insurance for workers, basically the equivalent of proper dole. They began giving abandoned shops to workers' cooperatives. In general, the National Guard, I think it had already been organized this way, but it was a kind of, it became completely democratic. And so that the people within the National Guard chose their own officers, basically organized amongst themselves to decide, you know, who's got the early morning shift or what do we have to do today or when we're marching. And the affairs of Paris work relatively well. Some say that their decision to take loans from the Bank of France would have been better if they just took the money. But others said, well, if they just taken the money, the franc would have been worth nothing. That's a debate which you can have. But either way, they found a way to take loans from the Bank of France, and they were paying them back as they provided, I think it was about 400,000 francs a day or a week to provide the funds they needed to start, you know, improving the lives of working class people in Paris. Very humorously, a group of middle class bourgeois people marched into the city asking for peace, which was not something obviously that they could have given to them because they weren't in charge, and the rest of France, the problem was the rest of France and the government there. And then they tried to march on a boulevard which was connected to the Bonapartists, and they opened fire on them. That was just a personal thing. There's something quite humorous about a group of bourgeois people with ridiculous wealth talking about, oh no, we just should have peace. And then they get shot by the Revolutionary Guard. Anyway, that's a kind of a dark joke on my part. But yeah, there's lots of little things they do to make people's lives better. And it should be remembered that they're not in power for very long. And so a lot of the ideas they had were much more long-term and they could never enact. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, as we're going to talk about in the next question, there's a lot of things they did wrong. And those are probably outweigh to some degree, you know, things they could achieve in such a short time, you know?
I mean, yeah, if they just thought about, you know, getting into cryptocurrency, then that would really have sorted their situation, I think. Or le cryptocurrency, as I believe the French call it. So yeah, if you want to get into,
maybe they should you had a currency of croissants. Oh, would you? I'll have two croissants, please.
If you could make a going on a moped to cheat on your wife with a mistress, if you could turn that into a currency, the French would be very rich. So yeah, if you want to take us through where it went wrong, then.
I mean, there's so many things that went wrong. I mentioned one there, which is that, I mean, maybe they couldn't have known that the Versailles government was as weak as they were at the time, but a bit of curiosity could have told them that. A little more connection with the rest of France could have told them that. So they were very Paris-centric, which is probably one of their greatest strengths and their greatest weaknesses. And again, they were in a siege for 5 months, so I get it. But the siege had ended. The initial Prussian siege had ended in January, February. And so there was about a month, month and a half, 2 months where they had connection with the rest of France and they didn't seem to know very much about what was going on. If they did know, they would have known how weak the government was and would have marched with far, far superior numbers to Versailles. In the end, I think they don't do that until the middle of April when it's way too late and are blasted with cannon as they got near Versailles. So that was a huge, big mistake. In general, not knowing enough about the rest of France or where France was. A lot of France was deeply conservative, deeply pro-monarchist. Still, the House of Bourbon or House of Orléans still had huge support. There was still Bonapartists around. They didn't seem to realize, and at no point really did, whether over the previous century, did many of the working class and revolutionaries in Paris seem to realize how much of an outlier they were in the kind of political spectrum in France. So that was a big problem. Secondly, they made things difficult with the kind of previous government that existed. So there was 20 mayors in the arrondissement, including Georges Clemenceau, who went on to be prime minister. And they could have found a way to gain something in the short term. Even that's debated. So, I mean, I'd leave that to the side almost as a quibble. Big problems they had were they could not get their act together on finding a way to defend Paris. And that's the biggest indictment of them. They spent way too much time arguing amongst themselves, talking about ideas for the future. It's kind of similar in certain ways to the mistakes that were made in Spain, which is, it's great. And obviously we're calling for a revolution, change in society. But if you can't defend your own doorstep, because you're too busy arguing over what you want to do in the future or who is a revolutionary traitor. I mean, you have a lot of the same things that occurred in the 1790s reappear, kind of traitors amongst our midst. And so there was the head of the army who was trying to get the National Guard to think like an army is basically called a traitor for doing so and has to flee Paris. And then his replacement tries to defend the few forts they had and does, but is told that he's a traitor anyway and is arrested. I mean, it's very, very similar to a lot of the kind of sectarian stupidity that you see a lot with the left. And so I think the greatest failure it had was, and in fairness to them, this was the first time that they had the chance to do this. And so it's more of a, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. The left has not learned from the commune, didn't learn from Spain or the Russian Revolution, and it's making the same mistakes to this very day, which is this idea of purity comes before necessity. And so if you have a reactionary monarchist army that's growing in size on your borders, and you can't even bother to arm or to take on the forts that are in the surrounding areas, or when it's the greatest, and I guess makes you want to smack at yourself in the head, was the French army got in the end was because how they got in the end was that one day one of the National Guard companies didn't show up to guard one of the gates. And so this guy who was a pro-government, the pro-Versailles government, was walking along and said, wait a second, that gate's not guarded. He went up to it, had a look around, and was like, nope, there's no one here. So he went up into the gate and he waved his handkerchief, his white handkerchief over, like, yoo-hoo, over at the troops. And they were like, it's one of those people.
Coming on to me.
Like, oh my, Paris is a bit ribald. But they went up and they were like, oh wait, it's okay, anyway. And so 60,000 troops fucking piled into the city because they just didn't have the ability to have two ideas in their head at the same time, which is you need to build a world, build a future based on kind of liberty and socialism. But in the here and now, that's not the battle you should be fighting. In the literal today, you have to fight the fucking government and the army that's on you, literally surrounding you, besieging you. And they just couldn't do that. And that was their biggest failure. And it is a massive failure because of what was to follow.
And to take it to, where the failures are again and again, though, I think that the commune, it's basically the first time that you see anarchists, communists, pro-communist socialists, the libs as well, actually, plenty of them within the commune actually work together as some sort of coherent force. And since then, it's been very hard to get these disparate parts together to come to the table and actually work together. And a large part of it actually comes from, the falling out of the commune. And the First Internationale, I believe,
the arguments between Bakunin and Marx were in the first.
Yeah, exactly. And as Bakunin, if I remember rightly, Bakunin said that Marx was a dictator, and so the way that Marx reacted to that was by throwing him out of the commune, the Internationale. And thus you have the origin story for why anarchists and communists still don't get onto this very day. But to put the positive on it, it showed you that you could actually work together and we can work together. So what is it they did to make that happen? Apart from the fact that, they basically, Marxism had just been invented like 5-10 years beforehand.
Well, I mean, it's a bit more complicated in this to say than it's just simply communists and anarchists. Because beginning of the podcast, we mentioned there was three blocks, the Blanquists, who were kind of Leninists, early proto-Leninists. There was the Neo-Jacobins, who were the inheritors of Robespierre, and there was the Proudhonists, who were anarchists. And really the largest bloc was the Neo-Jacobins. Then it was the Proudhonists, and then there was the Blanquists. Now, they all form there's two different committees, I suppose. One is formed of the National Guard, and one is formed of the kind of elected representatives from an election in late March of 1871. And so these two groups are kind of all mixed together of the different groups. And so there's a broad kind of, I suppose, left communism, maybe a kind of form of, I wouldn't say libertarian socialism, that's kind of in place from the revolution on the 18th of March through to about early May. And that worked to the extent that they were ignoring the reality of what was going on outside of Paris's borders. So, I mean, it's one of those things which is, you know, revolutions, if they didn't have to deal with outside or even in domestic governments, would probably find a way to exist fairly okay, because for the most part, you know, Marxists, anarchists, whatever sectarian label you apply to yourself, mostly agree with the idea of removing the state. They just disagree with how to do it and what order to do it. The inability, though, really to think about what was going on outside Paris is a huge failing, and you can't pretend like that didn't have something to do with the Proudhonist kind of ethic. And that's us, that's on us, kind of to not thinking about today and thinking solely about the social revolution, which I understand, I've always understood why that is, but I also have smacked myself in the head and said that's just, you can't pretend there's not 150,000 French troops, mostly drawn for the provinces, mostly believing you're trying to kill Jesus, because that's what they were told by their priests, on your borders, waiting to murder you, as indeed they would, because you think in the here and now, literally on this given day, that the support of a workers' co-op in northeastern Paris is more important, or, you know, drawing up plans for what's going to happen a year or two or 5 years down the road. It doesn't make any sense. It's living in a fantasy world. And I think the biggest indictment, which is also about them working together, was they lived in this fantasy world together. And it's a lovely fantasy, beautiful fantasy, and who wouldn't want to live in that? But it wasn't reality. So maybe to some degree, people who were of a Marxist-Leninist line realized that. I've read a lot of stuff for this. I think there's a lot of anarchists who don't realize that way of thinking isn't productive, and it will be proven throughout the 20th century not to be productive either.
So yeah, it all ends in disaster, though, with Bloody Week, when the provisional government basically brutally murder many citizens within Paris, effectively for being there. There isn't many trials to decide if they deserve it or not. So in terms of how has it affected the left and where it goes from now, where do you think the Bloody Week stands on that? Because I would say that this is you could discuss it till the cows come home, exactly when, you know, the state-sanctioned violence becomes a thing. But I think in, you know, the 1800s, you know, from the 16th to 1800, you're starting to get the idea of the move from feudalism into the move of, you know, some sort of idea of a state that is meant to be looking after citizens. It's when, you know, the idea of the social contract comes in, you know, through the Enlightenment. So you have this, you know, very different idea from, you know, what would be happening in France in the 1800s than in the 1200s. And this huge act of brutal violence pretty much, for me, shows you that it's, you know, the new boss is pretty much the same as the old boss, where if you do things that they don't like, basically they'll just use any means of violence that they can against you. So where would you think about that?
I mean, just to briefly go into what happened in Bloody Week. So I kind of told the listeners there how the army got into the city, as ridiculous and embarrassing as that was. That's how they got in. Didn't have a problem in the west of the city, which is mostly bourgeois and middle class. It had been shelling that part of the city for several weeks by that point, but they didn't have a problem. They moved through. They got into the center of the city. None of the barricades that had been begun to be built in the center of the city had been put up yet. And so instead, it was really just the kind of the working class districts in the north and the east that had been able to throw up hasty barricades. But they knew that the game was up. So they decided to do what damage they could. So, for example, they burned down the Toulouse palace, almost burning down the Louvre in the process. So, yeah, they burned down the Toulouse palace, the Hotel de Ville, kind of as centers of the old establishment. I think they also destroy a plinth, which was built by Napoleon for the victory at Austerlitz. They're basically burning down kind of elements of the old society, as they know that their commune has kind of failed as they're retreating into to their last stand. At that point, the army has already got the order to shoot on sight anyway, and there was basically a belief that if you were in Paris by this point, you were probably guilty, and therefore we can shoot you. There was a very common urban legend that women were running around the city, burning parts of the city down, including to the palace. They start stopping and shooting working class women. And it's estimated that by the time they'd finished, by the time they'd reached, they'd taken Montmartre Cemetery and the cannons there, by the time they'd reached the last few bastions, that probably 10,000 had died just in that week. And another 15,000 would die in the months that followed, as trials found about 90% of those they'd captured, about 40,000 were captured, but 90% got death sentences. So a lot were commuted, but in the end, about 15,000 were killed afterwards. So about 25,000 people ultimately would be murdered by any standard, you know, even by the standard of the 19th century, astounding viciousness. It's hard to see anything like that outside of really something that happened in Stalinist Russia. It was grim, very, very dark moment in French history, which obviously still shapes French politics today. You can still see that kind of class war. And was it the kind of beginning of the 20th century? Was it the end of the 19th? Some people have said that this is the French establishment trying for the last time to eradicate working class radicalism. And someone has said that they were successful, others not, that the working class radicals found other ways, maybe some more, quote, legitimate ways to fight the government. The French still to this day, when they have a problem, they do something about it, while the rest of us just kind of whinge and moan in pubs. So I don't know. There's a long legacy for what Bloody Week and how the establishment reacted to the commune. But it's a lesson to lefties. And unfortunately, not always lefties haven't always heeded that warning. And so Spain would be a good example. We had three episodes on it. I mean, anyone could have seen the massacres that happened when Franco put down the anarchist experiment in Catalonia as being kind of likely, if not inevitable, based on what had happened in the Paris Commune. And equally, you can see that in many other events, the Kronstadt kind of uprising, and how it was the kind of the sailors and soldiers there were massacred by Trotsky, no less. Again, to some degree, these things fit the same pattern. And so Bloody Week is what happens when you let, well, when either you let or circumstances make inevitable the victory of a reactionary establishment, a reactionary bourgeoisie.
So I would say that we've pretty much covered everything there. There's a couple other questions, but we've kind of already answered them as we've been speaking. So I haven't got much left to say about the commune. I do think it is important to go back and read up about it if you can do it, and try and wrap your head around some of it.
Do I have any closing thoughts? Basically, the commune, I think you need, I mean, I'm a historian, so I'm biased. I think you need to know your history to not make the same mistakes. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme, as I think Twain said that. But the point is, you need to know what mistakes lefties made in the past if you want to try and, if you want to just be anything other than a performative child of the professional class, if you do want the world to be better and change, you need to know how people who are identical to you, these people weren't only living 150 years ago. That was not a different world. It's the same world. Don't think of them like some Stone Age people. Don't pretend that what happened to them couldn't happen to us. Don't pretend the mistakes they made, you won't repeat with just as much fervor and just as much stupidity. They had a tendency to read books. We don't even fucking read books anymore. You know, just because you think you're watching cat videos on TikTok, you won't make the same mistakes as such and such person, the communards. We will make the same mistakes. But you don't have to. If you learn from these things, if you try and gain what you can from the knowledge of that and say, I'm not going to navel gaze if there's an opportunity, revolutionary opportunity, and I'm going to do the legwork in the decades before such an event even would happen, so that when it does happen, you can take advantage of it. So I would say the commune gives you all of that. It's a blueprint for what you should and shouldn't do. Unfortunately, I don't think many people on the left have listened to that for the last 150 years. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the position we are.
I think one of my best bits of research when I was doing was, it's up on YouTube, there's someone talking to Chomsky, and they go, oh, is Occupy Wall Street, it's very similar to the Paris Commune, isn't it? And that thing that Chomsky does when someone's asked them a stupid question, which I think if you knew Chomsky or you had him as a lecturer or something, if you ever made that noise, you'd just probably leave. Because he goes, he's like, oh no, I've asked a stupid question at Chomsky. And yeah, he pretty much sums it up though by just going like, yeah, well, you know, the Paris Commune were actually effective. So, you know, these are the things that you have to think about when you are looking at history as well, is not to make the false equivalents. They're always going to be different. I mean, you know, we were talking about the joke earlier about, you know, if they'd just gone into cryptocurrency. That's not true now. And I'm not saying like cryptocurrency is a solution for the left, but it's a possible scenario where you can work in to, you know, do something that means that you have finances that exist with outside of the state, which are the sort of things that you have to do if you want to succeed, because if your money is going through, you know, actual banks now, they've got an ability to freeze it, hold it, you know, this, that, and the other with it. So, you know, we can't always just be working within the mechanisms that the state has built for us, because you're going to fucking lose if that's the way that you do it. And that's what the commune taught us, is that you actually just have to do something and build your own structures, because otherwise you're set up to fail. So yeah, that's everything for this podcast. If you're interested and want to learn more about the commune, we're going to put some links into the description. The first one will be some lectures by a guy from Yale who's written a book about, what's his name again?
John Merriman.
John Merriman. John Merriman with his very bad comb over.
Appalling comb over.
Yeah, terrible dress sense this man has. But yeah, he's very knowledgeable about France, and he's written a book about the commune that apparently isn't too bad. And he's written a few books about anarchists as well. So we should actually maybe give them a bash at some point soon. Also, there's the very good revolutionary podcast, where each season is about a revolution, and he did one that's specifically about the Paris Commune. I think that's like 12, 13 episodes long. He tends to be very detailed.
It's actually 8 episodes long.
8 episodes for this one. Is that including the little small spin-off ones that he does, though?
Yes.
Right, okay. That's a very short one for him, then.
He was moving to Paris just before he did it.
Right. The last one that I listened to was the French Revolution one. So, and that was a good 6-8 years ago, I think.
Well, the Commune was 62 days long. The French Revolution was like a decade. So, yeah. I mean,
true. So, I've forgotten his name, but it's a very good podcast. Very often coming from the same thinking that we do, even if he doesn't explicitly say his leftist credentials. So that's everything. We'll be back next week with another episode of Yet to Be Decided. Any ideas, want us to discuss, pop us a message on Twitter. And we're also looking for a co-host. So if you know someone or are interested and want to come on the podcast, give it a try. Give us a message, I guess. Share it with your friends and enemies. So
if you think, oh, I don't know enough, then you probably do know enough. if you know how ignorant you are, then we want you. If you think you know everything, then we need you as well, because we're pretty desperate.
no, don't tell them that part.
Oh, wait. We're not desperate. We're very, we don't need anybody, but we do. Cool. We're really cool. Yeah. We're like China. Yeah. You're still cool.
So, yeah. That's goodbye from Montfort.
And it's goodbye from I'm drawing a blank.
All right, guys. Have a good week. Bye.
Bye-bye.